for appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal, if you wish. As you begin your arguments, please identify yourselves for the panel and for the record, and feel free to adjust the podium to your comfort. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Christopher Persky. I represent appellant Odell Branson, who's also present today. This case comes before the court on a direct appeal following a 2019 conviction in Hubbard County, stemming from two controlled substance sale charges. The issues raised by appellant are set forth as follows. Number one, simply put, did the interaction between defense counsel, the state's counsel, and the judge and the appellant during the appellant's trial testimony, did that deny him his constitutional right to testify based on a series of objections made by the state and sustained by the trial court? The second issue is whether or not the evidence that was in the record was sufficient to uphold the jury's verdict of guilty. Most notably, the first issue. This case, when we look at the framing of it, the series of question and answers that occurs within about 7 to 10 pages of the transcript identified by both appellant and respondent, It narrows that down to that section of defendant's testimony. The state has identified that, you know, there were only 6 objections throughout, you know, 40 pages or 22 pages or something, you know, longer. But we're looking at a series of rapid questions and objections within a short period of time on two important topics in the case and two important topics to defendant's testimony. Those are, number one, the defendant's or the appellant's interaction with one of the other witnesses. In this case, it was an informant that was participating in a controlled buy situation on behalf of local law enforcement, and who had identified the appellant defendant as a narcotics salesperson. So that issue, the testimony regarding how did appellant get to know the informant and that relationship. There's a series of objections that came in there. The second one was regarding the factual issue of where and how defendant or appellant stored and maintained the controlled substances that were in question in the case, which were alleged to have been part of the transaction reaching the conviction.
Counsel, you haven't challenged any of the district court's rulings on those objections, claiming that they were an abuse of discretion. So how can that have interfered with your client's right to testify if there's no claim that the district court erred in how it ruled?
The objections, the basis for the argument is that the overall conduct during that testimony was the error. Some of the objections were, one of the objection was sustained, or one of the objection was overruled, and one of the objections, the parties navigated through it without the court ruling. But the effect on defendant was the same, that the defense counsel was unable to present their defense on appellant's behalf in a succinct way that he should have been entitled to as a defendant in a criminal matter.
You know, I've read the entire testimony, and it struck me that much of the answers to the questions asked by defense counsel were non-responsive. They weren't directed. They seemed to be going off on tangents that occurred for a long period of time before there were any objections. Certainly the trial court, through how it ruled, had a responsibility to control the trial process. I'm having a hard time understanding how that implicates your client's constitutional right to testify when he in fact was allowed to testify, but didn't really answer the questions that were asked of him a large majority of the time based upon my reading of the transcript.
The issue regarding that is a defendant who's able to testify is afforded that opportunity. There was no objection or no limitation on his testimony when he was talking about his background. He got off on a tangent elsewhere in the testimony, and to kind of use what the court just explained.
Fair.
Thank you. There was no limitation or no management by the trial court in those areas for judicial efficiency or trial management. Instead, this issue came up in those two important and succinct places regarding what I would consider, and the court may consider, real important critical facts. What was the relationship between the defendant and the informant, and where was the substance in question kept? Those things were, it would be harder for me, I believe, or our appellant to argue before this court that if the issue of, you know, where his kids went to school or how long he's been living in the community and those types of things, those objections were raised and sustained. It's harder to claim that there was any impact or prejudice upon his case.
So were either of those questions that you just identified specifically asked from him that he was prohibited from answering?
In a way, yes, and in a way, no. Defense counsel was then required to go back and maybe recraft a question or re-ask the question in a different manner. Within the couple of spots where they occur, it was notable. Unfortunately, when you're trying to read a written transcript, we lose the drama of the courtroom of a live courtroom. And so some of the one area, it was apparent that defense counsel struggled to get a question back on track, and this is all in the presence of the jury. And when we get to the second issue, if we get there, the state has argued that the jury made a credibility decision between the informant essentially and the defendant. And these issues, if the defendant's testimony was thrown off and defense counsel struggled to get the questions out and the jury had to stumble through or was led to believe that something, the way the defendant was answering the question was incorrect or wrong, that is prejudicial. The issue, we don't have hearsay objections, we don't have other substantive more important objections. The objection that was raised and repeatedly sustained as being non-responsive is typically, in my trial experience, limited trial experience, but in my trial experience, is used by counsel when you have a witness that may not be yours, or you're trying to elicit some information and that witness refuses to answer the question or is trying to avoid the question. Here there's a cooperation amongst defense counsel and his client.
Counsel, if I can interrupt for a minute, and we do want you to get on to your second issue, but we're an appellate court, and so control of the courtroom under Rule 611 is within the discretion of the trial court. The judge sustained most of those objections. They go to form. So how are we, as an appellate court, to say that the judge abused his discretion or her discretion?
Well, this is a court of review. The issue here and that this court does need to review is not just its management of the court by the, or management of the trial by the district court judge, but an overview and oversight that the defendant's entitled to a fair trial and that that his rights are protected. I routinely am aware that appellate judges hearing in this proceeding were not in that courtroom. We weren't there. We didn't hear it. How are we supposed to change it? What we have is we do have the transcript that identifies those periods where the court could have either done something outside of the presence of the jury to manage that, could have let it go, could have overruled the objections or noted that it wasn't going to, you know, to do that. What we are looking at is that was the defendant appellant's opportunity to tell his story, and it may not have been told in the manner that the state would have liked, or even I guess that the trial judge, you know, would have thought, you know, appropriate or would have done it if he or she was in the defense counsel's position. However, that was the defendant's opportunity, and on those two particular issues, the narcotics location and the relationship with the informant, defendant being entitled to tell his story in his manner, in a way that still met, like I said, we're not dealing with hearsay issues, we're not dealing with speculation, objections. These were non-responsive. That basically you're not answering the question quick enough or in a way we want you to, so you know, let's get to it. If with other witnesses, that may be a necessary thing and part of judicial management of the trial courtroom. But with the defendant, with so much at stake and so much on the line, that defendant should be entitled or given the opportunity to present it.
Do you have any case law where the facts are like the facts of this case? I mean, where an appellate court overruled or reversed a conviction because the defendant was not allowed to tell the story in a very long and detailed way.
The case, I don't have one for this court at this point.
Okay,
right,
it's just
now
a yes or no answer. That's okay.
No, I do not at this time.
So why is not the testimony of the informant sufficient in itself to sustain the conviction?
And the state raised that. That's a very good question. It is appellant's argument that while the that testimony was presented to the jury and given, it was not supported by the ancillary evidence. It did not match the ancillary evidence that was presented in the case as well. And so the informant's, appellant would characterize as bald assertions, were contradicted or not coincided with some of the other.
I understand some of, like, for example, the audio recordings may not have confirmed or corroborated, but what other evidence contradicted the informant's testimony?
Thank you. The appellant is and the court picked up on it. Appellant is making the link between the audio evidence and the as it is compared to the testimony of the informant. That is the link. So, in conclusion, on behalf of appellant, we appreciate the court's consideration of this matter. These are important issues to him and as to the court. And Mr. Branson requests that this court reverse and remand for a new trial so that he may be given the opportunity to present a full defense in the manner that he seeks. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Persky. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota in this matter. As we've kind of touched on, Rule 611A governs presentation of evidence in a case, and defendants don't have free rein to present a case any way they see fit. There were form objections, no content objections, just form objections made and sustained. There's no evidence that despite the assertions here today, there's been no offer of proof providing this court with one piece of evidence that defendant was not allowed to present. Defense counsel was allowed to ask follow-up questions. He did. And with that, the second point of how appellant stored and maintained the drugs, I believe those were objections 4 and 5. Appellant did get to go on and talk about and describe how he had left drugs in his car. So as reading the transcript, it appears that his version of events was allowed to get in. So I don't think there's any error, much less plain error, and I don't see how there's any evidence of prejudice. I don't think you can survive the prejudice prong, the heavy burden imposed by the prejudice prong, if you don't have an offer of proof.
I appreciate your briefing on that. It made the situation more clear for me. I just have one question about whether the plain error test should apply. You say there was no objection, but what should defense counsel have done in this situation in order to preserve an objection or in order to somehow avoid the application of the plain error review on appeal?
Well, I can't remember the name of the case, but I cite to a Minnesota Supreme Court case where they refer to this type of issue as being unusual. And I don't know that I've ever seen it before where somebody is complaining about how the other side is objecting. So I don't have I can't look to a guidebook and tell you what the objection would be, but I just assume the objection would be approach the bench and raise your concerns to the judge about how the prosecutor is somehow undermining your ability to put in your case.
Along that line and along the line of the question, it's not specifically argued in the brief, it's mentioned, but it seems the way the issue is characterized by appellant is really they're raising a structural error here, that his constitutional right to testify was infringed. So really, would plain error even be an issue in the case if that were the way the court analyzed it?
I disagree that it would be a structural error. Structural error is, under Supreme Court guidelines, is confined to a relatively small area of cases. The Greer case that I cite in my brief mentions that the defendant's constitutional right to present a case is not unlimited, and it is governed by the rules of evidence. So 611A applies, and it's not structural error. It's just plain error. How it would specifically, I guess, would be an objection or a motion for a mistrial, a request for a mistrial would have would have saved it. But even, I don't think either, whatever standard of review applies, you have to survive, you have to come forward with some form of prejudice. And absent some offer of proof, I don't see how that prejudice hurdle would be cleared.
So counsel can repeated interruptions at some level in and of themselves raise the kind of issue that appellant has raised here of interference with the Sixth Amendment right?
Well, then there's two parts of that. Then it's the judge's response to what the state is doing. So as hinted to, that would essentially be a claim of prosecutorial misconduct. And, you know, that's a pretty strong allegation. And I would think that you'd need to raise that in a post-conviction case where a record could be developed on it. But here, I don't think any of these objections are untoward at all. The very first objection, as one of your honors referred to, that question goes on for three paragraphs. As you're reading it, that objection could have been raised sentences before when it was. I don't see any evidence that the prosecutor was attempting to undermine the defense here. They're just trying to get things back on track. So you'd have to come forward with some allegation that this was prosecutorial misconduct, and I don't see how a prosecutor could be accused of misconduct for raising objections that are appropriate. I guess you could conceive of one where the evidence is coming in badly and you just want to interrupt the other side, but that isn't what happened here. We don't have a string of six objections on one page. We have six objections over the course of 22 pages. And with respect to the second issue, I think it's pretty clear that that the evidence of one witness can support a conviction. And as Your Honor asked, is there any evidence that contradicted the informant's testimony? And I'm unaware of any. There, you can talk about these audio recordings. They don't corroborate it, but I'm unaware of any other evidence that specifically contradicted
other than appellant. Appellant testified, correct?
Yes, but I think they, in the context of the audio recordings and the observations.
The state's case was consistent?
Yes. I'm unaware of any evidence in the state's case that contradicted the informant's testimony.
I take it it's your view that this court need not apply the standard of review for circumstantial evidence?
No, absolutely not.
It is your position. I mean, you...
Direct evidence. There is direct evidence of observations made by the informant. So those observations can support the guilty verdicts. So there's no need to examine circumstantial evidence. I'm not sure what the circumstantial evidence would be. Even the audio recordings are.
Well, if there were
evidence.
No informant's testimony, I suppose the officer's testimony about giving the buy money, receiving back,
yes,
and so on. You know, they requires perhaps some inference.
Yes.
But my understanding is that the informant provided direct evidence in his testimony.
I would agree. If there are no other questions, I just ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Magnuson. Mr. Persky, you do have 5 minutes of rebuttal if you wish.
Just briefly, the two points. The court, I think, correctly indicated during respondent's presentation the issue that defense counsel likely faced in trying to remedy the continued objections, the court sustaining the objections, and still trying to move the case along and get some testimony in from his client on the witness stand at the same time. The again, well, and we heard respondent explain it again, where there were, oh, there were six objections over 22 pages. Now, when there were two sections, and the second in the transcript in the 170s, 171, 172, there was some definite back and forth and repeated objection, and the court trying to manage that, that did disrupt that portion of the transcript to try to talk about the topics that were being examined at that time. And at that, it is in those situations, I believe that in the transcript at 170s, where the defense counsel struggled to get back on track and elicit the testimony in conjunction with the court's sustaining the objection, that is where the struggle did occur. And again, it was raised, and I'll close with it, is the idea of this prejudice and the offer of proof was not so much that there was a piece of evidence that was unable to be asked and answered. It was defendant's ability to connect with the courtroom, with the jury, and explain and tell his story in a way that flowed and either allowed that jury to make credibility issues about him. Is he telling the truth? Do we believe him or not? And that is what appellant believes was lost in this process. So I yield the rest of my time and thank the court for this consideration.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Burstein. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments today and for your briefing in the matter. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue a decision within 90 days. All right, the next case on our calendar, as counsel's getting ready, is A19.